Welcome to Thursday night's chat show. This is the 10th week we've been doing this, and it's very, very interesting. I've been thinking about this all week. We've had two very interesting guests, and I was interviewed by Will Kintish. But I was thinking about mastermind groups. Now, I read about mastermind groups many years ago, and actually it was Napoleon Hill, and my American friends can probably correct me this, who first came up with mastermind groups and earned quite a lot of money for doing it for an American president who didn't want to be surrounded by yes people, by civil servants that always telling him what to do, but with a personal agenda. And I dug out one of my Napoleon Hill books today off the shelf. This one's called Your Magic Power to Be Rich. And he didn't mean rich in money particularly. He meant rich as a person, rich in the legacy that you leave. And this was really one of the first personal development books ever. And I set up two mastermind groups, which we run sporadically. We run them more as a chat with good friends. Gabby's in one or even two of them, I think. And we have a good evening, but we learn so much off each other. And it's not like the typical mastermind group where you ask each other what you've done and you put people under pressure. It's informal, but the amount of things and information that come out of it. And I see this going forward, if people want to, as a virtual mastermind group as we come out of lockdown. And if you're up for it, I would be delighted, because so many things have come out over 10 weeks. And when I look through Jill's notes, there is just so much information there. And last week we had 29 tips that came out. And I want to ask one or two people about those tips. And Kevin, I think you have to go after half an hour. You're looking so smart. You're obviously going to be paid a lot of money by somebody else, which is good. If I can help with the negotiations, do let me know. Kevin, my fee is pretty modest, but you know, I do understand fees are higher in America than they are.
It's interesting. I was talking to a coach the other day, and I said something like, what does it cost? He said, it's not a big number.
Like it.
Let's talk about what you need first. Yeah. And it was interesting. I immediately went, oh, okay, it's not a big number.
Oh, I love that. Gabby would call that a good anchor. That's a good pricing anchor to plant down there straight away.
Have you ever thought of bringing a mastermind group together that they pay you to moderate, to do what you're doing for us?
I did, and Godfrey was part of it. I called it an inner circle after I came back from Nido-Quabain. But I was only just about covering the costs, and it was taking a huge time, and people were promising to pay and didn't. They pulled out at the last minute. Mm. But I think we had three or four meetings, Godfrey, didn't we? And lots of things came out of it, so it was really good. And I got chief executive of a company called Dreams, which is a betting company in the UK, to come along and give us his experiences. So again, like this, we got lots out of it, but it was very hard work. And okay, I had to hire a hotel, and it kind of fizzled out because the energy and the cost didn't work. And
we have a thing called the Young Presidents. I think, Tim, is that right? Young President, YPO?
Yeah, YPO.
And then there's another one that has monthly meetings of non-competitive professionals, and it's run by a person. Mickey Williams runs a bunch of them, and I forget the name of it, but
Vistage.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, Vistage, right.
I've just written down Vistage. Now, Vistage is a franchise. It's pyramid selling in it, and you know, the people that run it have to pay quite a big franchise fee, and the people in it pay about £1,000 or even more a month to be part of it. I've spoken there, but I felt that the chairman of the Vistage group really wanted my knowledge to then negotiate and help his people rather than actually me getting some business out of it, because they pay a very, very low fee. So it didn't
work. We also had the Academy of Chief Execs, which was another one for the board you can't afford, which was similar, but Vistage have just kind of sucked them up. They're now part of Vistage.
Yeah.
There is one thing. You mentioned hotels. And of course, when we had a chat and I was last with you a week ago, I did say there are going to be lots of good lessons coming out of this to take us forward, diversification. But I also said, if you remember, that we may be able to do things a lot cheaper ourselves, and therefore there may be a smarter way of doing it. So you could do something, but virtual, as we are doing today, it wouldn't involve hotels.
Well, you weren't on Wednesday when I presented, Godfrey, but Kevin posed me a very tricky question that I'm still working out how I can monetize what we're doing. And I think I can. But Kevin, what I took away from that was sell it before you plan it. I love that.
Right. Yeah. And I, you know, when I said it, I mean, I'm interested because I'm very interested in how do we monetize this. But it was interesting. As soon as I asked it, Godfrey, all I heard were crickets. Nobody said a word. They were like, oh yeah, crap. How do we make money off of this thing? You know, but I think if all of us have this experience of being together and how valuable it is. And I wonder if we started to go after the clients we've already had who know us and love us already, but who we're not active with, and said, you know, I'm forming a group. It's going to be about 3 months or 6 months. The number, it's not going to be a big number money-wise, but it's an opportunity for you to get dotted out. And I wonder if that's a way to not only help them, but also take the expertise we've learned in the last couple of months through Derek's help to maybe, you know, I'm doing that 12-week seminar for spiritual directors in Chicago. And I mean, my students love it. I interview an expert every week. We have a chat. It's an hour and a half. I give them stuff during the week. They give me stuff. It's delightful. And but now I'm thinking, so how do I do that with like real people, not just graduate students, you know, like with professionals? So I don't know.
I think there's an element of working out what your motivation is, because I've written in the chat, I don't know if anyone's got the chat open, but I don't think Derek's motivation is money. But at the same time, doing stuff like this clearly can be monetized.
Yeah.
But equally, it can be done as a lost leader, so that you're inviting people in who then engage with you to pay you to go in and do one-to-one, and actually, rather than half an hour session, you go in and you spend a day, or you do a whole intervention with them.
Yeah, Derek's wife, Sally, could probably have written that, right? His motivation is not money.
Yeah. Kevin, I know you've got to go, so I'm going to ask you a couple of questions I didn't quite get from last week. And the first one is, you said dust off what you were doing, which I liked a lot. And interestingly enough, I had a long conversation with somebody that I first started working with 15 years ago, and they want to use me for all sorts of reasons. I'm not going to get paid, but I'm going to get huge publicity. So I've taken that one away already. You mentioned Kessler. I don't know who Kessler is. I don't know if the others do.
Yeah. Kessler is was a colleague who worked with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She's the one that did the 5 stages of grief. He added a 6th stage. She ended with acceptance as the last stage. He added meaning as the 6th stage. And I thought it was interesting because he's got a big website, if you want to look at it, it's about grief. But it's interesting, I think in the Harvard Business Review on it, he said, I asked her family if it would be okay to add this as a 6th. Now, we think maybe he's got some business arrangement with the family in terms of promoting her work now that she's deceased. But I thought acceptance for a long time was like, oh yeah, okay, now I guess I've come to some peace with this grief. But I think the meaning piece is so interesting. And I think that's what would be useful for all of us when we come out of this virus thing, is what meaning did this have? Not just, oh, wow, that happened and I got this done and that done, but what's the meaning that I've learned from this and how might it change my approach? And so Kessler is, he's still alive and he runs a website on grief. I forget the name of the website, but it's in a Harvard Business Review article called Maybe What You're Feeling is Grief. And he talked about anticipatory grief that we have and communal grief during this time of the virus. And I'm noticing now that I'm doing some work with healthcare professionals, they're no longer too worried about the emergency of grief of people dying. Now they're worried about, we're coming out of it, and now what do I do with my staff who has maybe some post-traumatic stress? There's a term I heard this morning called moral injury among healthcare professionals. And wow. So if you imagine, for example, I think it's in Montgomery, Alabama, they only have 3 beds for the ICU. But if 10 people show up, 7 people are going to be turned away. And the moral injury that happens for them and the moral injury for the person that's turning them away. They likened it to Vietnam when, I guess there's a rainy season that's very long in Vietnam for 3 months or something. And sometimes soldiers were not sure if their gun was even going to fire after all of the humidity and dirt and all that. And so the injury was, you sent us into battle, but you didn't support us. You can't land helicopters in the wet and my gun doesn't work. And they're thinking some healthcare professionals are saying the exact same thing. You sent us to the ICU, but I wasn't protected. And I wasn't protected not only with protection equipment, but I wasn't protected here. I wasn't ready. And so the psychologist I talked to today said he thinks there's going to be a lot of post-traumatic stress among healthcare providers because they've been stuffing their feelings for 2 months about death and injury. And then now it's going to start coming out.
So I heard a new phrase this week, new to me anyway, post-traumatic growth. And it was, you know, we've all heard of post-traumatic stress disorder, but how many of us have heard of post-traumatic growth and 100% had not heard of it? And it goes back to Kessler's thing. It's how do we gain meaning from what has gone on? How do we find ways to understand where we have developed, where we have grown? Because they say we can, you know, we can deal with anything that's thrown at us. It's just creating the mentality to find that growth, to find that strength that you have had in dealing with it all.
Wow. I want to turn to Kevin. I'll come back to you. Do give me a wave 5 minutes before you're going. I want you to turn to Godfrey, because Godfrey and I had a chat last week, and Godfrey asked me a very profound question. He said, we've been talking a lot about life and how to do things and about speakers, but what about people that are in the front line, a chief executive of a business, running it at the moment with cash flow difficulties, not being paid, not being able to invoice people, staff furloughed, etc. And I'm just going to ask Godfrey to say a few words about his thinking there and with a few tips, Godfrey, if that's...
Thanks, Derek. Yeah, I was just reflecting certainly on the meetings that I've attended and reading notes of others. There seem to me broadly the tips. We've had about, I would guess, 60 top tips, probably. There was the 20 in the Ryder Cup, and we've had 30 a little while ago. But let's say 60 top tips, all brilliant. I won't use Derek's word fantastic, but all brilliant, but a really strong word. And then I started thinking, we can probably break them down into 2 broad categories. I would call one philosophical. You could say the behavioral sciences, so motivation, leadership, communication, life skills. And in the other hand, I would say running a business. So maybe even starting a business. And what do business leaders really need to know in terms of nitty-gritty? And I think we sometimes lose track of the fact that it could be a sole trader, it could be a partnership, it could be the MD of a limited company, but they are faced with 1,000 quickfire decisions every minute of the day. And at the moment, it can get on top of them, but you can. It doesn't have to be today in coronavirus. It's generally they're faced with real nitty-gritty practical decisions. I would advise them sometimes to take time out and look at the more philosophical stuff. But day to day, they want to know, is my business plan working? Have I even got a business plan? Can I diversify? Which was one of the things I suggested during this particular period so that when I come out, I can be stronger and so on. So the chat Derek and I had was to say, at the moment, it just seems if we want to improve our conversations, everything's a bit of a mishmash, but there are these two sides to it. Both are equally valuable. But if I was, say, a young business person, I'd run out of money, I've got my staff on furlough leave, don't know when I can reopen my business and so on. Do I really want to understand some of the philosophical stuff, or do I just want practical tips on where I can go for help and what is going to keep my business alive until the better times come around again? And that's where I was coming from. I mean, I can elaborate, but I just wondered if you agreed and sort of shared some of these bits of thinking with me.
Well, I certainly did. And I did wonder if we should have a session maybe next week on just business tips, just cash flow, managing people, etc. Certainly the charity I'm involved in has huge issues, actually. And I'm glad I'm not a trustee on the board. But, they were running on borrowed time before this happened. And now the borrowed time's run out and their structure's probably wrong. They've got too many parent trustees on the board and not enough business people with quality thinking on both sides. In fact, they did a Belbin analysis. I didn't know this just till just now, a Belbin analysis, and everybody, I don't know the Belbin, I know one or two of you know it better than me. Virtually everyone is a social person. So they're on the board for the, to be a social loafer or whatever. And they're not hard nosed, can't see the strategy. Hang on, we're running out of cash. Don't know that until we run out of cash. Any thoughts, guys, ladies?
Are aware of the National Speakers Association in the US. They have decided not to have an in-person convention in August. So they released all of the web, last month and this month and next month, they're gonna have the workshops at twice a week on Zoom. And then in August 1, 2, 3, they're going to have a virtual convention. And they're doing about 50 hours of programming, and they're only charging $497. So for about $10 a session. And it's all, how do we make money now? What gets us in and out of this? What do we need to know? Everything from how to do this kind of stuff to how to think about your business in a different way, what clients are thinking. So it might be, I sent you a link, Derek.
I haven't opened it yet, Kevin.
To listen to, it might be something that I've been part of about 15 of their seminars so far, and they're quite good. So, Tim, your hand up before, were you?
Duncan. Kevin,
go ahead.
Duncan.
Yep.
What were you saying? Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we've got to realize is that this isn't about coming out of lockdown and next week or next month just returning to business as usual. We've got to understand that more than likely there is going to be a recession. How severe that recession is going to be, who knows? So I really do think there is going to be something about, you know, we're not talking about navigating through 6 months, we're talking over the long term. And I noticed EasyJet have announced a 30% cut on their workforce because they don't expect the airline industry to recover to 2023. So, yeah, you know, I think things are going to actually help people navigate through that. And I mean, I've been doing a series of interviews around challenging times. Derek very kindly did one with me around negotiating in challenging times. I've had people do on communication on challenging times. I've had people do ones around resilience, handling uncertainty. And, you know, they're all getting really, really good views in terms of, you know, just short videos. So I think that you can, there is going to be, I mean, Godfrey, you talked about the hard stuff. We absolutely need that. But there's also, you know, there's a non-hard bit to it as well. And I say that as an accountant because, you know, I mean, I know that speaking to people in the finance community, people are run ragged. There ain't enough hours in the day to get stuff done. And people working in finance right now, they've stepped up to the plate, but my goodness, the demands on those people are huge.
Yeah, I pick up on that, because one of the things I've always tried to do if I'm mentoring a small business, for example, an SME or a startup or whatever, is to try and put themselves in the shoes of the lenders and the finance people. Yeah. Because if they have an appreciation of the process and the thinking that these lenders have, they'd be more likely to ask the right questions or go about it in the right way. And at the moment, Duncan, you've hit it right on the head that they have never been, the finance guys have never been busier. They've never had so much thrown at them. And therefore the understanding and how we go about it needs to be reflected in that. And that's exactly the sort of help that I think certainly young businesses need. All businesses, but very mature businesses have got some experience, but the younger business and the younger business owners have no experience to fall back on. And that's where they need some, you know, nitty gritty help is what I would say.
And what you're talking about there, Godfrey, is having the emotional intelligence piece in there. And emotions currently, I think people are relaxing a bit more now that things are normalizing in this weird way, whatever normal is. But certainly initially, the emotions were really, really heightened. So the ability to make more rational decisions, I think, was almost removed, because people just didn't know that they were in fear of their lives, literally. It was, you know, that the limbic part of the brain was going 110 miles an hour. So it's interesting. There is a practical, but there's also the physical side, because body and mind are just so connected.
I was actually doing a pre-recorded webinar for an accounting association yesterday, because I was due to speak at their conference, but their conference has now gone virtual. I pre-recorded a career slot for them. But the other two sessions they asked me to do as webinars, one was around decision-making in a crisis, the other one was leading people through and teams through change. And on the, to pick up on Gabby's point, the on a decision-making webinar, which I pre-recorded yesterday for them, I said, it's partly about process, it's partly about attitude, and it's partly about behaviours, and I used a Venn diagram to illustrate it. So it's going to take all those variables. It's not just about, okay, follow this process and it's going to work.
What were those three, Duncan? I know you love the power of three: process, attitude, and
behaviours.
Behaviours, yeah. Okay, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. Can we move on? Because I've got a load of questions here. Tim. I was interested in your Dead Sea metaphor about what gets must give, and get the lift back down and give out some mentoring. But I didn't get the Dead Sea. I didn't realise the Dead Sea went nowhere except the atmosphere. I maybe need to read my historic books again.
Well, it's true that whatever has been given needs to get. And one of the things I always tell my students or the people that work for me is to be sure and mentor. And there's a selfish reason for mentoring. When you mentor someone, you learn at least as much as they do by the fact that you're mentoring. So when I tell people, be sure and send the lift or the elevator back down. After a 45-year business career, I will absolutely tell you that the greatest joys, the greatest achievements I've ever had is to mentor people who absolutely blew right past any level I myself achieved, including, you know, when I was with public accounting, when I was with Ernst & Young, I mentored some people. I wasn't even a partner, but some of the people that I mentored are now partners in charge of the Americas, or partners, a vice chair of the firm. And they still will send me a note saying, you remember that time that you took me over to the shopping area and told me that I needed to get my shoes brilliantly shined, and how you got on my case because my shoes had rubber bottoms, which executives typically don't. They get, no. It's all about, if you want to be an executive, how do you develop your executive presence? That was part of it. And then I worked an awful lot with women, women's groups, because I guess I'm a bit of a gender progressive, having four daughters. But it was all about understanding the difference between men and women in conversation. Women don't want you to solve their problem. They want you to listen, and they can then solve it themselves. Well, a lot of senior male partners did not know that. They thought that their role was to solve the problems of the women that they had targeted for advancement. It is very frustrating for the women. So it was all about mentoring. I mean, I learned so much from mentoring.
Thanks, Tim. Kevin's had to leave us, so never mind. He'll be back next week. Let's move now to Gabby. Gabby, you said resilience is how you recharge. I'm not quite sure I got that. When I was not resilient working for Barclays and running around feeling my blood pressure running at too high and my heartbeat too high for 16 hours a day, I didn't feel resilient, and I didn't have time to recharge. So what have you got to say about that?
This is the second part of it.
Yeah, you've just confirmed that resilience is how you recharge. You weren't recharging, therefore you weren't feeling resilient.
Oh, okay. Why didn't I meet you 20 years ago then?
Steady.
You did. You met me 20 years ago.
Oh, I never. 30 years.
We're getting older.
Yeah. I obviously never didn't listen then, did I?
So, resilience is how you recharge rather than how you endure. Because if you are constantly going at that kind of 100 miles an hour, and you're not taking the time out to stay sober, and by that I mean, it's a lovely acronym, stay sober. It's stop, observe, breathe, evaluate, and then respond. And what tends to happen when you're going at 100 miles an hour is you are reacting, rather than evaluating, taking a breath, and responding more appropriately. And so the resilience is about the taking the breath, making sure that you're eating well, making sure that you're sleeping well, making sure that you're taking the time out and not going at 100 miles an hour all of the time, because that leads to burnout. Yeah. And burnout is not a resilient point. Tim?
Could I support that with a quick comment? The man who wrote the book, The Black Swan, Nassim Taleb, he wrote another book recently called Anti-Fragile. And what he talks about there are people that when they meet stress, they crumble. In the States, we call them snowflakes. Okay, they just can't hear anything about Trump, or they can't hear anything about whatever. There's people that crumble, and then there's people that are resilient who can bounce back, exactly how Gabby just described. But what he's discovered is that there's a group of people and a need for us to develop something called anti-fragile, which is when we encounter stress, we actually don't just bounce back, we become stronger because of that. And that's what's going to be very important going forward, because there's going to be an awful lot of resilience needed as well as agility. But it's a fabulous study. You can get a summary of Anti-Fragile a number of different ways. But I think we all need to be aware of it, because it's a burgeoning field of study.
Thanks, Tim. Somebody,
Gabby, can I just, Gabby, what was the B stand for?
Breathe.
Breathe.
Yeah. But not just in your chest. Do some proper deep breathing, or box breathing, or, you know, the breathing that Alison's taught us and Tim's taught us. And yeah, proper.
Thank you.
Take a breath.
Stop, observe, breathe, evaluate, and respond. Yeah, somebody gave me Black Swan about 10 years ago when it first came out, and I had a quick look at it, and I didn't take to it at all. And then a couple of years ago, someone mentioned it again, and I read it, and I thought, oh, this book's really good. It's interesting how sometimes you pick up a book up and you think it's not very good, and then it's interesting. I'm reading that book you recommended, Tim, last night, and that's an amazing book as well. I've forgotten the name of it, but the one I bought in hardback that you recommended, but I'll mention that.
Humility is the New Smart.
Yeah, it's on the kitchen table at the moment. I was reading it last night.
The people from Oxford.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's some good stuff about. Who's who hasn't said anything yet? Who have I left out? I think a couple of people didn't make it, Will and Martin. Maybe I locked the room too early. I'll probably be in big trouble over that. But
you can
never mind. Never mind. Gabby, what was...
Are you prepared that everyone had turned up that you were expecting?
Yeah, I know I did. I think I got that wrong, Jill. Don't worry. But no one's texted me, giving me a hard time. So I'm probably all right. Yeah, I was a bit short of time this afternoon.
I just need, I'm compelled to speak about something that is very near and dear to my heart that was brought up earlier, and I'm sorry that Kevin is gone, and it's post-traumatic stress. I actually work with former military that are suffering from post-traumatic stress. I have a son that is disabled by post-traumatic stress, but I work with the lone survivor, Marcus Luttrell. They made a movie out of him. Here's what I want people to remember. Number one is post-traumatic stress only affects, less than 20% of post-traumatic stress sufferers are military or ex-military. That means 4 out of 5 people that are not in the military and have never experienced war are suffering from post-traumatic stress. And I think we're right on that. It's an awful lot of healthcare workers, as an example. I mean, the head of ER for New York City, she killed herself a month ago because of all of the stress. There's an awful lot of suicidal ideation by frontline people in this COVID deal. The other thing is, I don't know if it's the same in the UK, but we never use the term disorder. It's post-traumatic stress or post-traumatic stress syndrome. But in the US, because of the preponderance of lawyers, attorneys, whatever you call them, solicitors, a soldier can lose all rights to their children if they are diagnosed with a disease. And post-traumatic stress with disorder is disease. Now, I could tell you real quickly what my son would do if he had no access to his children. So we're trying to get that disorder away. Again, it might be a U.S. problem, but in California, soldiers are losing their families left and right when they need them the most.
Shocking.
It's through divorce.
Wow.
Tim, what's ER? What's ER?
Emergency.
Emergency room.
Say that again.
A&E.
Emergency room.
Oh, emergency room. Okay.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah,
A&E over here.
Okay, thank you.
Or the doctors who treat these people, lots and lots of stress, and they're crumbling. They're dying.
It's really interesting because I had the opportunity to hear a guy called Frank Pusilik speak. Frank developed the early program within the US military for dealing with PTSD, or PTS, as you say. And he talks about this model where you train somebody to become effectively a killing machine, to have the values of relying on their weapon, on their buddies, you know, to have each other's backs. And then when it comes to the end of their service, you take their best friend, you take their weapons away from them, and you send home these people who have been changed something which is he says akin to a monster. And his program really is how you help people to grow through that, and having gone through hell, to become effectively some kind of shaman, where they are able to transcend what has happened to them and, as you say, be able to support and mentor others, but also be in a situation where if their kid creeps up behind them, they don't behave in a way which threatens the kid's life.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is a fascinating guy to speak to.
We're taking people of very formative age and teaching them skills that when they get done with their tours have no application in the US or the UK in civilized society. They don't know what to do. And also with regard to PTS, it's very connected to what their situation was before they enlisted. In other words, if they had a lot of trouble before they enlisted and then they went through war, they suffer much, much more from PTS.
Wow. Gabby,
but here's the key.
Sorry,
it's not soldiers. We've got to address our friends, divorce, sickness, everything.
And there's going to be a lot of issues around that. Can I move on to the next question I had, and it was for you, Gabby, and I think Jill chipped in because she knew what it was and wrote it up in the minutes. Haiku,
haiku. A haiku.
Yeah, I didn't know what you were talking about.
No, I could tell.
I was probably the only one. I was probably the only one. Everybody else knew it.
A haiku is a form of Japanese poem. And when I was first taught it years ago, decades ago, I was given a very strict format for it. I've since befriended the chair of the Haiku Association, and he's much freer around the rules and regulations of how you put a haiku together. And I'm still learning it because I write haikus regularly, and he'll say, "Oh, that's a good one. No, you need to change that. You need to," and I still don't understand what I need to change. But the basis of it is, and Jill, please, because you clearly know more than me, the basis of it is that you deal with what is in front of you. So as an example, I sit here in my space, nine faces looking at me, an oak tree beyond. Because that's physically, that is currently what is going on. I am sitting here, I have nine faces in front of me, and I've got an oak tree just beyond. But because there's ambiguity there, and because you're using, you're smashing different things together, it can create different meaning for different people. The main reason for mentioning it when I mentioned it, because I was talking about spend 5 minutes a day noticing and being present, is it enforces you to be present. So last night, as an example, I was awake for 3 hours. I couldn't get to sleep. And I was doing haikus. So the traffic moaning in the background, my breathing, the door slamming from time to time. Now that probably is not no good as a haiku, and I'm sure Colin would slap my wrist for it and take great delight in doing so. But it's just noticing what is going on so that I'm outside of my head of, oh, I'm wondering, you know, what am I going to do tomorrow with that client and what am I going to say here? And it's just bringing yourself back to what is going on.
Brilliant. So was that your poem, Jill, in the notes?
Say again, Jill?
Yeah, what I was going to say to Gabby was you're treating it as a kind of meditation.
Absolutely.
And I saw one or two people going into a trance when you were doing that, Gabby. So, you know, it was obviously working. A bit of your hypnosis language coming in there.
I've still got it. Phew!
Of course, for people who don't understand anything about hypnosis, and I didn't till I went on my NLP course, Erickson's language is to confuse you, isn't it, Gabby? You know, to have double meanings. Is that the Milton model or?
Ambiguity is key.
Can you give us an example?
Oh, you are really putting me on the spot today, aren't you? Jill, help me.
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll come back to you in a moment. But very fascinating stuff coming out today. Questions, guys? Any questions for the chat box or from the audience, not from the guest speakers? That's a no, is it? I mean, the recording's still on. We get questions when I turn the recording off. Tim, in your book, Moving from Promise to Performance, you talk about never using the word should. Interestingly, Linda Shaw on Monday used the word should and slapped herself at the time. And I think Tony or someone asked her why she hesitated, which is very interesting. Have you got a second to expand on that, Tim?
Sure. The word should is okay, but the word should have or should have is very damaging, because should have is in past tense, so you can't do anything about it. And when I say to somebody what they should have done, it also makes us feel very defensive. Like, what do you mean what I should have done? Like, you could do any better, like you were there. So it's in the past tense, and it's direct. It makes people feel defensive, and so that there's nothing that you can do about it. What we suggest, and by the way, elite performers never use the word should have. I should have kicked that ball better. I should have taken the shot, or I should have passed it over to the open forward, whatever. They don't say that. They do say next time. Next time I'm going to do this. Next time I would do that differently. Next time. But I always make a joke out of it in the States, saying, don't get shitty with yourself. Don't get shitty with your kids. It's incredibly damaging to young people to tell kids what they should have done. The worst question you can ask a kid or a young person, or actually a colleague, is after an event, a speech, a meeting, a performance, the worst question you can ask is, how'd it go? Because we live in a negatively charged environment, have for years and years now. So what children especially will do is they'll go to the negative. Well, I didn't do this. I messed up that line. I forgot that. I didn't hit the open striker, whatever. And then they compound it, and it just kills their self-image, which is one of three areas elite performers guard jealously, is self-image. So, never say should. Never should on yourself. Never should on anybody that you care about. And certainly never should on a colleague.
If people say it to me, Tim, I say, are you shooting on me?
Yeah. Well, you being NLP will understand the tremendous damage that can be. There's so many problems, but it's past. What you want is future focus. That's why the words next time, so much better.
Yeah, the language we use is really important. Actually, that's the question that most speakers get asked afterwards, isn't it? How do you think it went? And I go, well, I gave it my best shot. What do you think? I did about 5 hours preparation.
Yeah. Well, to give you another example, do you all know who Garth Brooks is? Garth Brooks, the famous country music star.
Yeah.
Okay, so a friend of mine.
Too young.
Friend of mine went through his house, had occasion to go through his house. He's won every award that you can possibly win many, many times. And not one of them is in his house. Nothing that he has ever won is in his house. And they asked him, why don't you have your gold records, platinum records, your Academy of Country Music Performer of the Year? He goes, because that's about what I've done. I have no interest in what I've done. I'm only concerned about what I'm going to do. And I just thought, for a guy who's won more awards than maybe anybody in music, that's pretty strong. Yeah. And by the way, he quit when his 3-year-old daughter pronounced a word which we know as both, B-O-T-H. He said, which do you want, one or both? And she said both, but she said it in the language of her nanny. And he was so upset that he wasn't raising her his daughter that he quit music for 10 years until he could be at home with his kids. The wow. signal was he couldn't, she was learning a different culture than his. And he thought she should have both. So anyway, I love those stories, but it's all future focus, not what you did in the past.
Tim, I wonder if in a week or so you'd come in and talk to us about elite performers and what you've found. I'm fascinated by the subject of modeling the highest achievers, and I've always tried to do that as much as
possible. I will happily do that. I'd love to do that.
Yeah,
because there's a lot there, and there's a lot more that you can use.
Okay, that'd be fantastic if you do that, because you said last week, and I was a bit surprised by it, but I had to think it through. You said that only for elite performers, only 2% is goal setting, and 98% is doing it or practicing it. Did I get that right?
Well, yeah, it's so many people get into goal setting, and Gabby knows about the well-formed outcome and all of that, but the real effort. And that's about outcome, but the real effort is about process. Because believe it or not, a world-class shooter does not try to get the bullet into the 10 ring or the bullseye, or a golfer does not try to get it in the hole. That's not their mental image. Because that's the outcome. They can't control that. What they can control is the process of all of the things that they need to do to give it the best chance to go into the bullseye or to go into the cup or to go into the goal. They can control the process, but they cannot control the outcome. When I talk to world champions, I say, when you're competing, what are you thinking about? I talked to 3 in one night, all world champions, and 2 were Olympic gold medalists. And they looked at me funny and they go, nothing. And I go, nothing? And they go, no, I don't think about anything. I just run my program, which means they take their breath, they set their body, they do their preload. I'll get into it next week if you want. But elite performers think very differently than us.
Tim, could I ask you a question? Come back sure. on that. Tim?
Yes.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
I'm too old. I don't get some of this. So if I wanted to chastise somebody and say, you should not be doing that, as a lesson to him, so it registers. That is what I want, because I don't want him to do it again. Should there be another approach?
Yes.
And what is it?
Do you have an example of somebody doing something wrong?
A young child stealing something off of a teacher's desk, like a yep. pen or paper or something okay. like that. I don't know.
So a child...
Yeah, no, I've got one. Our golf courses have been closed down. There's yep. some youth, some yob, riding his bike across the green.
Yep.
I said, can you not read the notice? Should you not be doing that? He just told me to piss off.
Yep.
So that's an English vernacular term, which
yeah. I don't really understand. I understand. In that particular case, there isn't anything that you can do in terms of, you can say, you know, you shouldn't do that or that's wrong. But here's what I would say. If he got caught and he got thrown in jail or fined a great number of pounds, I would then go to him and say, I would not say you shouldn't have done that. I would say, what did you learn? What did you learn? Well, riding a grass across greens can be very expensive and can cost me 3 nights in the pokey.
You're in the immediacy. You want to tell, sorry, you're in there. Say it's your own son. You want to give him a lesson so he doesn't really, you want it anchored, as Gabby would say, in his noddle.
Yep.
So,
do that again.
So the thing, the types of things that you are able to say is, oh, that's unusual. You don't.
That's a joke.
You would normally do X, Y, and Z, and actually reinforce the behaviours that you want. In a school locally recently, they changed all the rules from, you know, don't walk on the grass, don't do this, don't do that, to what they wanted children to do, because the brain doesn't understand the word not. So if you say, you know, don't think of a pink elephant with purple spots, in order to think of a pink elephant, in order to not think of a pink elephant with purple spots, you have to think of it and then wipe it out. So when you're telling someone that they shouldn't be doing it, A, you're using should, which is ridden with guilt, and you're saying not. So in order for them to understand what they should not have done, they have to, in their mind, relive what they did, which is not the behavior that you want them to be performing. So you've got to create the image, create the ability for them to actually do what it is you want them to do.
But if they're punished immediately after you said should not, under glass detention?
So with my kids, and they laugh about it now, I would say, that's a really interesting way. And you've already, Derek's already said that I was really hard as a kid, as a mum. That's a really interesting behaviour. What are the implications of that? And, you know, this happened and that happened and all the other. And is that the right behaviour? Is that the sort of behaviour that you think is acceptable?
No, mummy.
Okay, so what's the punishment going to be? And they would create their own punishment. It drove me crackers, because they would create really, really harsh imposition on themselves, which I then had to enforce. So I was then saying, I tell you what, I know you've said it's 3 weeks that you're not going to have your phone, and every hour is like, can I have my phone? Can I have my phone? Well, why can't you have your phone? So what are you going to do? I tell you what can you do? Good behavior to win some merit, to be able to get the phone earlier, so that I didn't have the hassle of having to police it. But people generally, if you've brought them up and they've got a moral compass, they will know what is the best behavior. And they will know the shortcuts that they were taking and the reasons behind it.
Guys, we can continue this discussion, but I'd like to just close the recording off, because in case anyone needs to get away. Fantastic discussions. I've written down all sorts of things. Business tips, post-traumatic stress. What's the worst question you can ask anybody? The real effort is in the process, etc. So thanks for all the tips, which is absolutely brilliant. And I look forward to seeing people next week. On Monday, we've got Shelley Rose Charvet on, who is Jill's favourite trainer, coach, etc. She knows more about NLP than I've had hot dinners, but she's not necessarily an NLP person. She wrote a fabulous book called The Words That Change Minds. So see everybody next week. Thanks for joining, and I will turn the recording off now.